Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tonight on Truth and Movies, live from the Prince Charles Cinema in London, we discuss the Safdie Brothers indie gem, Daddy Longlegs.
You're here, finally. You're not responsible enough to be here to pick them up.
It's my screw up. I'm entitled to screw up, and you can screw up for the rest of the year. How you guys doing?
Good.
Comfortable?
No.
All right.
And then we review the Super Safdie's latest release, the Adam Sandler starring high-stakes drama, Uncut Gems.
Howard, where's the money right now?
Howard, got my money?
Howard! Is it too late?
I'm done. That means nothing. It meant nothing. Please. Give me another shot.
All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. Listeners, as you can hear, we have some friends in the room. Tonight, we thought it would be better to be Safdie than sorry.
No. That happens every week.
Thank you. You don't usually get such a positive response from Hannah. This week, or well, this episode, we're going to talk about two Safdie Brothers films. What we usually do is we have the new release and then Film Club. We're going to swap it round because we're in a room full of people who've just seen Daddy Longlegs. So I think we should kick off with that film. So do you agree, David, to give that the editorial stamp of approval? So I'll give a little bit of a plot synopsis. First released in 2009, Daddy Longlegs follows the deadbeat divorcee Lenny as he looks after his two sons for 2 weeks while also juggling his unpredictable work and social lives. So Hannah, you programmed this screening. Could you tell us why?
Yeah, sure. I think listeners of the podcast and anyone who knows Little White Lies in general will be aware that we're big Safdie boosters and have been for a long time, since heaven knows what, I guess. And when we did our Uncut Gems issue, I thought it would be a nice kind of opportunity to maybe dig back into their quite short back catalogue and play one of their films as a kind of tie-in screening. And Daddy Longlegs never actually got a proper UK release. And it's still quite hard to find. It's not on DVD. I think you can get it imported, but it's never really played. As we discovered, very hard to get a print to play as well. There are none in the UK. The closest one is Germany. So, we thought it would just be nice opportunity to kind of celebrate this really great film. I think it has a lot in common with Uncut Gems, mm-hmm. and I think it was really just, well, it was this or present a screening of Uncut Gems. I thought hopefully people would get something out of this and get a chance to see a film that doesn't screen very often.
So for those who haven't seen the film, what would you say are the points of comparison between this and the film like Uncut Gems? They make 10 years later, bigger stars, bigger budget.
I think the idea of a father kind of desperately scrambling to provide for his family is very prominent in both films. They based Uncut Gems and Daddy Longlegs on their own childhoods and their own experience of growing up with a father who was not always there physically and emotionally. So I think that's the kind of big comparison. This, I mean, it obviously feels a lot less polished. I think the soundtrack is a lot. I say soundtrack, the sound of kind of gunfire, very ambient all the way through. And also, of course, this was their first film with the involvement of Ronald Bronstein, who has gone on to become their kind of co-writer, co-editor, muse. And I spoke to Ronald Bronstein about the process of making this film with them, and he described it as basically being harassed by Josh Safdie into making a film, and he's not an actor, he's not starred in anything else. And he said never again after making this film. He found it so stressful. But I think, yeah, it's kind of where it all started for them. And I think definitely if you watch Uncut Gems this weekend, or if you've already seen it, in fact, listeners and people in the audience, it's very obvious that these guys were kind of onto something, even all the way back in 2009.
David, we're both recent fathers. Did you get any ideas from this film?
This was a horror film for me. This was just going back to the question you asked before about kind of the connectivity of their films and these overlapping qualities that they have. I mean, they do tend to make films that are kind of character studies on a single person, and I think what one thing that they seem to do in every film is they create a situation that is just kind of you would never believe could happen. You know, or someone would make a decision that is not based in any kind of rational reality, and they kind of manage to sort of sculpt a film around it. So you reach that point where you think, okay, yeah, I do actually believe that. There is a sequence where that involves sleeping pills, mm-hmm. and the protagonist Lenny, played by Ronald Bronstein, who doses his sons up.
And so an eighth of a sleeping pill.
Yeah, he gives them too much, it turns out. But I think there is this a film by a lesser filmmaker or lesser filmmakers. I think you might have you could have trouble believing that someone would actually imperil their children in such an obvious and sort of knuckleheaded way. But you kind of you believe it, and you somehow still don't hate him for it. But going back to the fatherhood thing as well, another weird thing about this film was that there were sort of impulses wrestling inside me about, on one side thinking, oh my God, he's, you know, these kids should be dead. And on the other, it was like, oh my God, I wish I was like running around with like urine trucks and It looked kind of like, in a weird way, kind of fun. And up to a point, I think the kids themselves seemed to be having like a good time with dad. Mm-hmm. But I think runtime of the film, you're going from a point where they're sort of deeply in love with him, or, you know, like you know, it's a fun, jolly time, to actually getting to that point where it's like, no, I'm not sure this is all that fun anymore.
I think this is a film that's almost been given new context as their career has gone on. Some of the contemporary reviews of this film, it premiered at Cannes, Director's Fortnight, and showed around the world, were quite mixed. And some of them say this is a document of abuse. The father is being neglectful. And if they lived through this, they have some real stuff to work through. But they really managed to balance that out between some really abhorrent stuff, but as you say, maybe it was quite fun at the time. And Hannah, I wonder, when you talk about this shared DNA with their later films, they do have central protagonists who are pretty reprehensible people that we can't help but root for, actual criminals in later films.
Yeah, I think it's a common theme throughout their four features so far that all four protagonists are, they do unlikable things, but they are not themselves unlikable creatures. I think you can, like David said, you can totally kind of understand the thought processes that are going on in Lenny's head all the way through. But very much in the same vein as Howard Ratner, he paints himself into so many corners where you just kind of, you want to take him by the shoulders and shake him and say, stop, you don't have to do this. And I think the kids feel like that as well. There's that look of resignation when he turns up at the school near the end to kind of spontaneously pick them up, and the kids are just like, oh God, here we go again. You know, there's this kind of, I think, especially like I'm a child of divorce and had a fairly bad father. And I think it resonates even more watching it when you can kind of see that and go, well, yeah, actually, yeah, I understand kind of where he's coming from. But I think it's strange to me that people would kind of watch that originally back in 2009 and think it's kind of a document of abuse. I think, you know, it's trying to kind of be honest about mm-hmm. something and not paint it with the kind of grey shades that exist in, you know, childhood. I think there are a lot of things that many of us have probably gone through that we think now, that probably wasn't cool, but at the time you just kind of get on with it.
It's a real time capsule of American independent cinema circa 2009 to read the reviews, because they were still throwing genre terms like mumblecore at this
point. Well, yeah, I mean, I watched The Squid and the Whale for the first time the other day, and I think it's a very kind of, that I could see that working as a double feature.
And the Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah, yeah. All these terrible dads.
I think talking of the tone of it as well, and that kind of sense of danger and darkness that kind of lingers over it. There's also, on the other side, you could almost see it as like slapstick comedy, like or like a kind of, because I mean, I can't remember who said this, but like. Apparently, one of the films that was an influence for this was Big Daddy, the Adam Sandler film, and which I happen to have watched really recently, just out of the blue, and there is quite some significant overlaps. I mean, this isn't as sentimental as that film, I don't think, but there is certainly a sense of like, you know, we're not going to demonize this guy for his kind of lack of parenting skills.
Listening to the audience in the room and watching it again myself, it's a lot funnier than I remembered it being. Actually, there are some great like comedic beats, and the kids are fantastic. You know, they're little superstars. The way they kind of riff with Ronald Bronstein is just incredible. The whole scene where they're arguing about turning on the light and whether or not it's going to attract mosquitoes, it's just incredible work.
And he's an incredible physical comedian. From the very first scene where he just slips over with his two hot dogs crammed into one bun, later on where he just decides to start doing a handstand.
He's Kramer from Seinfeld, isn't he? The kind of indie version of Kramer.
And it's amazing to think that he did direct a film, Frown Town?
Yeah, Frownland.
Frownland.
Frown Town.
He was more ambitious than I thought he was. And then now spends his time in the edit suite and co-writing their screenplays. Right?
Yeah, I mean, if you watched the film, everyone in the room did just watch the film, you saw him in a projection booth checking on 35mm prints. And I believe it was shot at Lincoln Center, which is where Ronald Bronstein worked up until Good Time, doing very well at the box office, at which point he was able to quit his job and leave.
And Josh Safdie also has a cameo in that sequence as well.
Yeah, I've forgotten he's in that. Yeah,
I think they wrote a lot of the films actually in the booth as well.
Yeah.
Just while he was changing reels, they would, between reel changes, they'd be writing together.
They wrote Heaven Knows What and Good Time in the projection booth of Lincoln Center Theatre. So if you go to New York, there you go.
So if any of the Prince Charles staff up there in the booth are writing right now, they could be the future Safdie brothers. We should plug that we interviewed both Josh and Benny before Christmas, didn't we? And we asked them about this film. And the interesting thing is they've had kids in the interim. Or at least, did they both have kids or just Benny?
No, just Benny. Yeah. Benny's had two kids. So there was a lovely moment where he was trying to find a picture from the set of Daddy Long Legs to show me on his phone. And I don't know if this made it into the podcast, but he's scrolling through his phone going, I'm looking for a picture of a bathroom with kids' toys in, but that could just be my bathroom. So I don't know anymore. Mm-hmm. I think I'd be super interested to hear kind of how the film has changed for him since he's had kids of his own, definitely.
Yeah, very interesting. Where would you rank this alongside the other four features together?
Well, I told them in the room it was my favourite, which I think is probably still... I think it's probably this and Uncut Gems are my two favourite. But when they've only made four films, it's kind of a cheat to say two of them are the best.
Yeah. David, where would you put this alongside the others?
It's a good one. I mean, this is the first time I've seen it just now, so... But yeah, no, it was very good. You put me on the spot here on the rankings. I really liked. I won't rank them, but I will say that if you haven't seen Heaven Knows What, that's like, I mean that takes a turn for the really dark. I mean, I think that whereas this shows a kind of slightly lighter comedic side, Heaven Knows What is really really dark, but quite kind of weirdly cathartic as well, and it kind of it just really sort of pins down their commitment to this kind of, you know, we're gonna take things to the edge and then tip it over and then tip it over again kind of thing. So
fine, I'm gonna stand for good time then.
Yeah.
I think it's watching the four as well as like different areas of New York is very is really interesting. I mean, this is obviously Brooklyn, and then good time was Coney Island way, Long Island, Queens, Queens. It was Queens. Okay. Sorry, and then Manhattan in Uncut Gems. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, kind of how well they know the city. All of their movies, I think, could only be made by true New Yorkers.
In fact, that's one thing that I think is another thing that connects, or certainly what I think about when I see their films, and I think having seen this now, it's the rule certainly applies. But they make films where you would be happy, any person who appears on the screen, you'd be interested in seeing a film about them. So like, you know. The casting is incredible.
And or the little exchange between the war veterans. Of course, we see the beggar in the subsequent scene. But the other guy, I want to follow him home with his $20. I want to see what he got up to. But that's something that is in every film, their street casting. Even when they are casting bigger and bigger stars, as they can do now with the ilk of Robert Pattinson or Adam Sandler, they still have those little characters, don't they?
For the time being, that's something they like to do, is kind of have that juxtaposition of, like, you know, real A-list actors. But like rubbing up against these kind of weird street toughs that they've just kind of nabbed off a corner. And
what fascinates me watching this film, being such a low budget film that, you know, they made very early in their career, clearly, you know, off on their own steam, you think that cameos from famous people or notable people would be something that would come when they have the pull. So Uncut Gems, you know, has basketball, famous basketball players in, not a voice cameo from people who won't spoil for anyone in the room or listening who hasn't watched that film. Whereas this has weird cameos for fans of No Wave New York music. Like, we've got Lee Ronaldo from Sonic Youth there playing the stepfather, and his sons are the sons. And it's so bizarre that, so clearly they were insidery people, knowing like Abel Ferrara to bring them in.
Well, I think there is a thing about how they've got like a big King of New York poster in their office, and I think he is there.
You need more than that to get Abel Ferrara on your
movie,
though.
No, of course, of course. But I think he is their kind of number one hero, and most kind of biggest inspiration as well for what they do. And they've got this kind of let's just go up and ask kind of vibe to them. You know, they meet people in the street. That's kind of how they make their films. They've got that kind of like. You know, they're like their characters, I think, in a sense, in that they don't have that. They're not shy, basically. No.
And that actually makes sense, because they approached Adam Sandler right after this film, didn't they, to work with him?
Yeah, straight away. They were like, well, okay, we've done one, and he did okay at Sundance. We'll go for the big guy. And he said no.
They already had Uncut Gems
written there. They'd been working on that kind of basically as soon as they finished this. I think they wrote the script and took it to Sandler's publicist.
And Sandler went and made Jack and Jill.
Yeah, and signed his Netflix deal, made a lot of money. But then I was reading an interview with the Safdies after Uncut Gems, and they said, obviously, Sandler became aware of them after Good Time, but it was Daddy Longlegs that he really connected with, and that was kind of what sold him. And I think you can see why. I mean, based on, I imagine, what the kind of sell was to him. I keep saying there's a straight line between the two, but I really think those are the most kind of similar films in their four film.
Well, we're going to draw a straight line between the two films now. That's Daddy Long Legs. Listeners, if you can find a copy of it, we really recommend that you do watch it, and let us know what you think when you do watch it at the usual channels. That's at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comment section at lwlies.com/podcast. Up next, we're going to review the Safdies' latest film, a new release this week, that is Uncut Gems.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Adam Sandler stars as Howard Ratner, a charismatic New York jeweler, always on the lookout for the next big score. When he makes a series of high-stakes bets that could lead to the windfall of a lifetime, Howard must perform a precarious high-wire act, balancing business, family, and encroaching adversaries on all sides in his relentless pursuit of the ultimate win. Hannah, in your review of Uncut Gems, you called it a devastating fever dream.
Yeah, I did do that.
Could you walk us through this fever dream?
I very much stand by that. I think that every reviewer going has called this like an anxiety attack of a movie, and as someone who's had a lot of anxiety attacks, I kind of agree. But I was expecting it to be, you know, very much like Good Time, a kind of high stakes, high octane New York runaround, which is what it is. But also, there's so much sadness in this film, and I think primarily it comes from the fact that this main character we have, Howard Ratner, is so he's such a schmuck in the kind of the truest sense of the word. He doesn't know what he has, and every character you meet who is close to him loves him. Everyone loves Howard. You know, it's just his kind of people he passes on the street, or his family, or the heavies that are chasing him. Actually, they really like the guy, and they kind of want him to succeed, and they want him to do better, and stop his kind of relentless swindling and gambling ways. And I think that's the saddest thing, is this idea that this man is just so helplessly trapped in his own hubris and his own kind of misery that he has no idea what he has. And I think all the other films that they've made are about kind of desperate people in desperate circumstances, and often kind of very unfortunate people, you know, drug addicts, single fathers. Whereas Howard Ratner is a very successful man. He lives in this beautiful house on Long Island. He has a beautiful girlfriend in a very nice Manhattan apartment. So there is a kind of sense that everything bad that has happened to him, he has brought upon himself.
This might sound like I'm, again, it's an intervention or a therapy session, but can you unpack your love of Adam Sandler for me? And is this his best role?
So when I was about eight, I used to have a video store that I went to every week, and my favorite VHS was Little Nicky, and I must have rented that. We rented it enough times that eventually they sold it as really cheap, because they were like, you come in here every week, why don't you just buy it? And then I broke the tape because I watched it so much. So like, I am deep in it. I have been for a very long time. I think that he is one of America's like greatest comedic actors for a start. But then, you know, you watch films, his more dramatic films like Punch Drunk Love, like The Meyerowitz Stories, like Spanglish. And I think he has so much depth to him and emotional range that he doesn't kind of get enough credit for. And watching a film like Uncut Gems, it could only have been made by two people who totally understand the kind of mystique of Sandler. And listening to the Safdie brothers talk about how much they love Adam Sandler is the most kind of charming thing in the world. I think a lot of critics and a lot of kind of people out there, ironically, like Adam Sandler, they're like, oh yeah, Jack and Jill. The Safdies genuinely love the guy. They are very much in it, and they understand his appeal, and they understand kind of his strengths as a performer. And Yeah, I guess I'm the same in that I grew up watching him and was kind of very defensive of him. And now I don't have to be because he might win an Oscar.
Well, reading and listening to the Safdie brothers in interviews, it's really fascinating. I don't know whether it's a sort of hipster thing about them not seeing high and low art as two separate things, but they generally do love all cinema. And there's an opening shot in Uncut Gems, which is quite a special effects shot. And they were being interviewed by Nick Pinkerton for the Film Comment podcast, and he said that in his writing he referred to it as being like 2001 or these various other great visual effects spectacles of the ages. And they said the visual reference they used was Look Who's Talking, the opening sperm shot, as you see it. And I find that really fascinating. David, what do you think of Uncut Gems?
Very good, very very good. Yeah, no, it's just sort of carry on from what you say as well. Like, I think the similar deal with Paul Thomas Anderson as well. When I remember when Punch Drunk Love came out, and he was just hounded by questions like, you know, this was at a time when I don't think when the very notion of Adam Sandler being in a film like that was just like, but completely bizarre. I mean, the only films he was known for were like The Waterboy and, you know, going a lot. You know? So he was just fielding questions like, so you really like Adam Sandler? And it was just Paul Thomas Anderson going, yeah, I really do like Adam Sandler. That you really like it? It's like, yeah, I really like it. So yeah, I think it's probably been a bit easier for Safdie brothers to actually get that point across. It's actually weird talking about the film here because this was where I first saw The Exorcist in 1999. I think I was in the back row. It was when it was re-released for the first time.
Right.
And I think the chairs were different then as well. They were bigger. But the film is like The Exorcist. I mean, it's got this kind of, well, firstly, it starts in Ethiopia, and
right.
In this scene where these two guys uncover this uncut gem, this black opal, which we kind of discover that Howard Ratner, Sandler's character, has purchased off them through various kind of weird back channels, and then the film is essentially him trying to sell this opal, and you're watching the film and it's essentially a very, it's kind of a straight, you know, you maybe see it as a straight drama, as people, you know, people talking, and it's done in a very kind of realist way, and people talking over each other and arguing, but then there's this kind of undercurrent to the film where the gem itself holds this kind of mystical allure that somehow changes people's minds, or just erases their sense of morality or their sense of like logic or just something. And it's almost like a kind of MacGuffin in the film that whenever it's present, people's minds just are kind of blown by it. It's like it's got that devil quality to it, and it just makes people do stupid things. And again, like I was saying before, the way that the film's made, you don't necessarily, it's not done in a kind of, you know, hot genre-y way, or, you know, or a horror-y way even. It's this kind of almost like fantastical idea is sort of planted in the film in a way that you wouldn't even really see it, or you could watch the film and it wouldn't maybe not even go, maybe not even notice it. But I think the thing that I love about this film is it's got that kind of weird mystical element to it that is kind of, that messes with people's minds, and again, so many points in this film you're like, would he, oh my god, I can't believe he'd make that decision. I mean, this film is essentially the varying stages of this character making decisions, and you're thinking, oh, I can't believe he'd make that decision, and then, oh, I can't believe he'd make that decision, and then it just ramping up till one at the end where you're like, Jesus. But then the thing that makes the film amazing is the way the Safdie brothers, through everything, through production design, through their casting, through the dialogue, through the editing, they make it feel real. They convince you of this guy being a real person.
Do you find that these sorts of films enjoyable to watch? we talk about it in terms of fever dream, panic attack, anxiety attack.
I find
what pleasure you take from these films?
I think watching a film like I think maybe more so than something like the Daddy Long Legs, which is, I think, a really not great film, but like it's got that kind of rough phone quality to it. Whereas I think I'm watching Uncut Gems, and there's scenes that are kind of almost the artistry is just so like there and in your face, and like there's one sequence where Kevin Garnett is returning to Howard's office, and he has this kind of two-tier locking door system where he has you buzz them into this little kind of antechamber, and then and then once that back door's closed, then they can come in, I guess, as a sort of, you know, security measure. And there is like this kind of it's like a kind of five-minute farcical, just like tearing your hair out sequence where the lock breaks, and Kevin Garnett has the gem, and he needs to get through the door to give it to Adam Sandler, and Adam Sandler is trying to keep them there while trying to unlock the door. And the way it's edited, and the sound, the music, the sort of interplay between people, it's like symphonic. It's just you're watching this sequence thinking, this must have taken like weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks to edit.
It's like a horror farce.
It is, yeah. It's a horror farce.
I really love Good Time, and I really like Uncut Gems as well, but I find them so hard to sit through because you're squirming almost from the word go, and the way they use the soundtrack, the way they use people talking over one another, lots of shouting, lots of street ambient sounds, it's just overwhelming. And you come through at the end. It's almost like this sort of religious epiphany sort of thing that you have at the end of their movies, and you can go out and breathe the wonderful air of the outside.
Well, in this film, that I think there's a sequence where they have like they just add on really loud traffic noise to one of the scenes in the apartment, and it's like that's the kind of, I think that's probably the shot and the sequence that you could probably take and say this is a Safdie Brothers film. It's a film with really loud traffic noise in your ear, and it's just like getting up in your head.
I find them very easy to watch, all their films. I mean, I've seen Uncut Gems 4 times now. I'm going to go again next week.
I've seen it 7 times.
I didn't mean that as a brag. I just meant it as like a show of commitment. I have become like a Mormon going door to door with like, have you heard the good news about the Safdie Brothers to people? Like,
did you end up buying the $250 Furby?
I did not. I came close. But I think for me, like, my greatest joy when I go to the cinema is watching something that completely transports me and takes me away from whatever cinema, whatever location, whatever troubles I have brought in with me to the cinema. Something that just completely I can focus my attention on for 2 hours, 5 minutes, or 1 hour, 40 minutes, however long. And I think that for my money, there's no kind of filmmakers coming up like the Safdies that do that for me, certainly. I think the worlds they create and the kind of the way that everything comes together in their films, and it's a case of not only having amazing casts, but having amazing crew who all kind of are on the same page and all work together so well. They kind of are very, very good at creating things that I really tune into on a kind of cerebral level.
I certainly can't deny that. I just find every wrong decision just makes me coil even further inside myself.
Maybe it's because I make many wrong decisions.
I fear making those decisions.
Just watching it going mood all the way through.
So let's put some scores on this film. So we give films that we review for The White Lies 3 scores: in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect, times however many times you've seen the film. How do you want to go first?
I gave this scores when I reviewed it for Little White Lies, and to reiterate, it was a 5 in anticipation because I really loved A Good Time and I really love Adam Sandler, so it was kind of all my Christmases came at once. The second I saw that iconic paparazzi shot of Adam Sandler running down the street with his mobile phone, his iPhone 4 in his hand, I was sold. So 5, and then it's 5-5. I don't give out many triple fives, but I really stand by this one.
Do you think of any other triple fives in your career?
A lot of 4-5-5s. I don't think many triple fives.
It really is that mystical object.
This is my bedazzled Furby. My uncut gem.
Yeah, I think you referred to Adam Sandler as your jellicle choice on this week's episode.
I did, and I stand by it.
You stand by that. Is he your jellicle choice, David?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd probably give it a 4 in anticipation because, there is that kind of watching their films can be tough sometimes. but I mean, it's fives across the board otherwise, because mainly because I think being in the company of Adam Sandler is just a joy. I mean, he is so good in this film. I mean, I think it is a bit of a... I mean, we're talking about, like, Oscars and stuff like that, but this performance is not well-liked across the board, certainly with the kind of, you know, hoity-toity people who vote for in awards bodies. So it's a kind of real... I think it's good that the critics' bodies are, like, giving him his dues, where the sort of maybe the more kind of conservative awards bodies might not, but he absolutely deserves it. I mean, it's like, it's a one of a kind performance, really.
Did you say the numbers there?
Oh yeah, fives, sorry.
Fives across the board. Gosh, I'm sorry, fours across the board for me.
Boo.
Oh no, gosh, I'm going to be shunned.
You're entitled to your opinion.
No, I really like this. I like Good Time a little bit more just because I think that Robert Pattinson, I'm more of a R. Pattinson man than I am a Sandman.
I like them all. As I can. I'm a woman who contains multitudes.
Perfect. Okay, thank you both for your scores. And thank you both for joining me tonight. And everyone, thank you for joining us this evening. We will be back next week with an episode in which we are reviewing A Hidden Life, the new Terrence Malick film, Bombshell, the awards hopeful, and for Film Club, if you want to send in any opinions on the Terrence Malick classic Days of Heaven, we'd love to hear them. Thank you very much once more. I'm Michael Eder, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production. Thank you for joining us.